Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for the kindness of downloading, subscribing and rating. It may be a subconscious effort. It might just be that it automatically downloaded into your podcast feed and just loaded up. But we appreciate your sticking with us as we try to bring you some entertaining science from the world around us. Coming up on the things, I don't know where I'm going. I've had like 12 cups of coffee. On this week's podcast, we're going to talk about memories. And if you, like me, are someone who really struggles with memory, and I increasingly am bumping into people and I have no idea who they are, although I know who they are. Like only a few days ago, I bumped into Owen Sheehan. We were both semi-naked, which was kind of weird. You're in a sauna thing. I went for a swim at the 40 foot. It's my friend Guy. It's his 50th birthday, and we went for a swim. We had a little shot of whiskey. Then we went for a sauna, and then we went for lunch in Calvison's. Lovely day. But I bumped into Owen as he was like 1 foot into the hot tub. And he was like, "Hi, Jonathan." And I was like, shit. And I could not place his name, even though I see him all the time, I hear him all the time. He's on the News Talk, you know, the website. He's all over the place. I could not place the name. Because, in fairness, it's an unusual place to see someone. And so I struggle with memories. And on this week's Future Brief, we're going to be hearing that potentially the memories that you've forgotten are actually there somewhere. And that in that moment, that very much felt like I did know Owen's name. If I'd had a bit more time, I would have gotten it, right? But because it was in that moment in time, I couldn't get it, but I knew it was somewhere there. Maybe that's true for a lot of our memories. We'll be speaking to a researcher who's doing neuroscientific research on real-time memory formation. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the world's science news. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, by the way, you can email us, scienceatnewstalk.com. We get to all that stuff at the end of the show. So, joining us for News Round this week are Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Tara Shine, environmental scientist. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Ruth, has to do with blood.
It has to do with blood, and it has to do with sort of the idea of a frontline worker taking on a whole new meaning, because this is pediatricians really stepping up to help their patients by giving their blood to research. And it's about a virus called respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, which most parents will have heard of, mm-hmm. because pretty much every child in Ireland gets it at some point by the time they're age two. And it can be quite serious, particularly for young children. A lot of the time, it's the reason why little kids end up in hospital during the winter. Now, in 2024, the HSE introduced a vaccination program, which essentially gives a dose of antibodies to babies. So it's not a vaccine that stimulates their immune system to create vaccines. It just gives them the antibodies directly. And that's been pretty successful. It's dropped sort of hospitalization down by about 60% over the last in the babies that have been given the treatment. But it's still not a persistent treatment. So they would have to get it every winter. And it, of course, doesn't work for everybody. So this research is from China, and they took the blood from 10 pediatricians who had worked in the children's hospital for more than a decade. So these guys have been exposed to everything. And they looked at their blood, and they were able to identify, they went and looked at their B cells, and the B cells are the part of the immune system that are the memory cells. So once you've produced antibodies to something, it's your B cells that carry around those memories, so that if you get infected again, you can respond quickly. And they found 56 different antibodies that could specifically latch on to the RSV virus. And they tested those. And one of them beautifully also links to another virus called metapneumovirus, which people will have heard of as HMPV. And that's something that we have no vaccine for. So they've now created monoclonals out of these. So they've basically made them in the lab. They've made a cocktail by bringing together the best three candidates that they found. And they've tested them in animals in the lab, and it's been really, really successful. They completely protected the animal's lungs, and they essentially locked down, prevented the infection completely. So these were like 25 times more effective than the existing antibody treatments that we already have. So this is great because, you know, for old and vulnerable people and very young people, these are really serious viruses.
That's amazing. Excuse me. that isn't. It's a sort of a...
It's talking about the common cold.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of a sympathetic reaction. I'm thinking now about other people in other environments, like people who work in sewers, for example. Yeah. Like, are there super immune systems out there that we should be latching onto?
Well, I mean, this actually reminded me of the study. A guy, he was called Friedland or Fried, who allowed himself to be bitten by loads of venomous snakes because he then used his blood. It was essentially built up a source of antibodies and things that could be used for anti-venoms. So, yeah, exactly. It's a really exciting idea. The people who put themselves in the front line, or in this case, the front line of toddlers that are exposing them, you know, they could have real medical value.
Fantastic. If you were smart now and you worked like in a really horrible place, you could go to a medical company and say, I'll sell you a bit of my blood. Our second story, Tara, is an interesting one. It's about how skills become second nature.
Yeah, so it's all about tacit knowledge. So that being that kind of things we do, like they're second nature, it's internalized instinctive things that we can't explain. We don't even know they're there enough to put them into words. And so a team of engineers in MIT wanted to know, could they detect this kind of tacit unconscious knowledge? And if they could detect it, could they also teach it? And yeah, it was pretty interesting what they found out. So they came up with a really kind of simple test. It was visual. It can combine shapes and patterns. And they created 121 of those images. And then they got 30 volunteers to look at these images and to try and categorize them. And what the engineers and scientists knew that the volunteers didn't know, that was that it was only one side of the image that actually mattered for the categorization. But they had to figure that out. And they tracked the volunteers as they went through looking at all these shapes and patterns. So they used eye tracking and EEG sensors to kind of look at where their brains were being activated by the images. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that over time, so in the beginning it was guesswork, they were novices, to be honest, they were just guessing. But over time, their brains unconsciously shifted over to the side of the image that actually mattered. And they started to get better and better at sorting the shapes.
Huh.
So they start, their unconscious knowledge started to kick in and work.
So and were the volunteers at any stage asked why or what they were doing so that we were that the research showed it was unconscious?
So when they were at the end of the experiment, when they were shown what the pattern was, they hadn't realized.
Hmm.
They hadn't noticed. It was completely unconscious that they had sort of got into this clue or cue that was in it. So they didn't know that. But when this was pointed out to them, what the factor was and what their tacit knowledge had picked up on, they became even better and better at picking up the cues and doing the sorting. And so what this study has done is it's the first one to show that A, we can reveal that there is such a thing as tacit knowledge and show it. But then also that if you reflect that back to people, their expertise gets better. And so that has applications in everything from how we read x-rays to kind of how skilled tradespeople build walls or, you know, design jewelry, all kinds of things like that. So pretty amazing.
So give me, like, how would you do that for something like how tradespeople build walls? How would that work?
So again, tradespeople are building walls. So they'll over time, they'll know which stone to pick up to put into a wall. They'll be automatically using these patterns and sequences to be able to pick the best stone for that particular piece of the wall. And they, in their skilled way, they're very good at that. What this study starts to show is there's ways to kind of identify when that particular type of tacit knowledge is coming in and possibly then use that in the training of future tradespeople to make them even better, more effective, more skilled at the task.
But how would you identify when that tacit knowledge is coming in?
Well, I guess you'd have to go back and do more of the experiments like they've done.
Yeah.
They've just done it with these visual classification tasks. They haven't done it with anything else.
Yeah. Okay, very cool.
There's more to go. But yeah, basically being able to identify that kind of second nature hidden knowledge and then work on it and expand it.
Brilliant. Third story, Ruth, has to do with ChatGPT. And a lot of people using ChatGPT, it seems, for understanding what's going on with themselves. Microsoft says that the number one reason is what people use Copilot for is health.
And exactly. And I mean, there was a study done last year in Ireland which shows that 1 in 10 people in Ireland are using some sort of AI chatbot to get life advice or as a form of therapy. So that's a lot, and it's a growing number. And I guess the reason for that is somewhat intuitive. I mean, you're sort of talking about your deepest, darkest feelings, but it's feels totally private and confidential. Mm. And I guess for a lot of people, therapy just isn't obtainable. It can be very expensive, and some people are uncomfortable with it. But really, while there's been a lot of talk about this, there hasn't been a huge amount of good research. And this is actually a really impressive piece of research out of Brown University that was published in the proceedings of the AAAI Conference on AI, Ethics and Society. And it's a study that went on for over a year, and it looked at ChatGPT, a couple of different ChatGPT models. It looked at Anthropic's Claude model and Meta's Llama model. And they were all prompted to act as excellent therapists. And again, if you go online, if you go onto Reddit or any forum, there's instructions to tell people how to get these things to act as therapists.
Right.
So the researchers then created simulated therapy conversations. So they presented the models with fictional scenarios with lots of different kinds of psychological distress, could have been delusions, trauma, you know, interpersonal conflict,
right,
but also suicidal thinking. So really quite serious problems were presented. And then over the course of a year, as these conversations progressed, they had professional therapists assess the responses that were coming back.
Very good.
And the analysis identified 15 different risks, which they've categorized into 5 categories. So the first one was that the advice that the AI gave was generally pretty generic. So it didn't tend to tailor the response to the person who was asking. So, you know, whether you were a 17-year-old college student or a retired 65-year-old woman, you know, there was no context provided around the kind of advice that you might be given, even though those could be quite significant factors in what you might choose to do.
Mm.
So, you know, the advice could be inappropriate because it didn't take into account that specificity.
Mm.
And the other thing,
even though the specificity was in the prompting.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It was in the prompting.
Mm.
And the other thing, and I found this really interesting, was that the therapy wasn't collaborative. And I suppose what a professional therapist will often do is they don't just solve a problem for you. That's not what they're there to do. But that is what AI is programmed to do. It's there to get to the answer as quickly as possible for you. But a key part of therapy is actually self-reflection, learning about yourself, growth. And often therapists will even hold back to give the client an opportunity to go through that process. But this didn't happen at all. And often the AI was getting to pretty radical outcomes in like 3 minutes, which doesn't allow a lot of personal growth in that time period.
And what do you feel about that?
Well, that's the other kind of thing that they felt. You know, so ChatGPT frequently says things like, I understand, I hear you, I understand how you're feeling, which is a pretty incredible thing for a robot to say, essentially. So they call this third trait or this third bucket of problems deceptive empathy. And they see that as problematic because people really believe that they are getting this empathy.
Mm.
But of course, that can lead to overtrust and overinvestment in a system, which is ultimately a large language model. The last two issues, one thing was actually discrimination and bias coming out. So we've all heard a lot about this in large language models, which kind of contrasts with this idea of not taking into account specifics, but it would also pick up biases and give different kind of advice to people depending on what it had picked up,
mm,
whether it was women or, you know, it might bring religious aspects of someone's life into the conversation. And then I guess the last and probably most concerning thing was the AI didn't generally flag when someone was getting to a point where they were potentially going to put their own safety in, you know, that they were not taking account of their safety, you know, they were considering taking their own lives. It did not escalate them. It did not guide them towards the proper paths. And again, it often prompted people to take pretty radical action. You know, there was one story I read where an AI therapist told someone to cut off all contact with their family after only a couple of minutes of a conversation, mm, back and forth. So prompting people to take radical, radical steps. So look, while there's definitely, people do find support in these always
well,
on models.
We don't have an enormous amount of time to kind of dig yeah, into, because it's actually a big story, but
yeah,
I guess compared to having no therapy at all, because, you know, when the first autonomous car death happened, there was a huge amount of media, yeah, associated, and it wasn't reflective of the amount of lives that are saved by that. So
yeah,
deaths will happen, and this sounds, you know, when you read these stories, these personal stories, it sounds awful. The question is, do more people benefit? I do not know the answer to this, but do more people benefit than people don't? Or is it just completely unacceptable, regardless of the benefit, if tragedies happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you've put your finger on the issue. You know, I think AI, it's clear it can be a support tool or a screening tool. I think what people need to know is that they should not use it to take radical life decisions. Mm. And I think if you're aware of these shortcomings, you can actually get potentially a lot of benefit out of it. It can be very useful, you know, with interpersonal conflict, play out scenarios, yeah. Get advice. But there certainly are health warnings around it. And of course, it's totally unaccountable. Licensed therapists are accountable. You know, if something does go wrong, someone can go back to them. You know, they can be held accountable. They can be taken off the record. So, yeah. You know, it's a really important conversation, because more and more people are definitely going to be using these tools.
Absolutely. Tara, our final story is a short one, but it's about hedgehogs.
Yeah, and I thought this was just a nice one given the time of year. So at the moment, hedgehogs are waking up from their hibernation and they are stumbling around hungry and disoriented, which means that many of them get killed on our roads. So 1 in 3 hedgehogs ends up as a bit of road mortality. So that's
1 in 3.
One in three.
Oh, come on. This is supposed to be an Anne Finally story, Tara.
I know, but so in good
news. 2 in 3 survive, Johnny.
Yeah. In good news, the University of Oxford conducted a study of 20 hedgehogs in a Danish wildlife rescue centre, looking at their auditory brainstem response to different noises. And what they found out is that hedgehogs responded to noises all the way from 4 kilohertz up to 85 kilohertz. So they can hear really, really high frequency ultrasound noises. So way more than a human, way more, up double what a dog can hear, for example. And so that means that it may be possible to design devices to warn hedgehogs to keep away, but that don't bother your pet in the back garden, for example. Mm. And what I thought was really interesting was, as part of the study, they created a 3D model of the hedgehog's inner ear, right, using high resolution micro CT scanning. And they found that hedgehogs have unusually small and dense middle ear bones, along with a partly fused joint between the eardrum and the first ear bone. And all of this makes them have a really stiff middle ear, which is the kind of structure that better transmits these high-pitched sounds.
Right. So kind of like those mosquito devices that were developed for nightclubs or for convenience outside stores to get rid of teenagers, might be used for hedgehogs as well. Although the idea of us creating that solution at the side of a road to kind of ward off hedgehogs and make their environment unpleasant to be in, I suppose being squished is worse, yeah, right? Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. Now that I think about it, it's actually not a bad idea. Brilliant. Dr. Tara Shine, Dr. Ruth Freeman, thank you so much. Welcome back to the programme. This is Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, what really happens when we forget something? Is the memory truly gone, or is it just out of reach? New research suggests our brains may still be quietly replaying memories even when we're not conscious of them. Joining me now is Dr. Benjamin J. Griffiths. He's Assistant Professor of School of Psychology at the University of Nottingham. Ben, welcome to the programme. Tell me a little bit about your research. How do you understand something like memories? Because we still don't fully understand how they're stored and how they work, do we?
Yeah, no, you're completely right. I think this is part of a challenge, really, that we're all very, very familiar with memory. It's something which helps us kind of just get through the day, but we also kind of just have no clue how it works. And a lot of my research is trying to understand that a little bit more.
Yeah, so you are using a really interesting technology. This is fairly recent, right? The magnetoencephalography.
Yeah, it's definitely growing in popularity. More and more research is kind of taking it up to really kind of get deep into what the brain is doing.
So what is it, if you wouldn't mind reminding us, and you might tell us a little bit about your experiment?
Of course. So, yeah, we usually abbreviate it to MEG or MEG. Essentially, whenever our neurons fire, they release a little bit of electrical activity, and this electrical activity is also accompanied by some magnetic field changes. This is the M in MEG. And while the MEG can't pick up on single neurons, if lots and lots of these neurons all fire together, that produces a magnetic field that we can detect a change in. So MEG lets us see what's happening in the brain in real time by measuring changes in magnetic field.
And you don't need to crack open someone's head for this.
No, that's the beauty of it. These magnetic fields kind of propagate through the skull. They don't get distorted. So all you need to do is just sort of sit in the chair in the MEG and we can record it without doing anything invasive at all.
And how accurate is it in terms of seeing, you know, obviously there's different regions of the brains, of the brain responsible for different things primarily, although we know that it's an orchestra of activity, but there are certain areas that are more associated with motor function, for example, or you know, cognitive thinking or memory and so on. How accurate is it? Like, can we see a particular part of the medulla firing up, or is it not as precise as that?
It depends where you're looking. So we're always measuring from the outside. So the closer the brain region is to that outside measurement, which we're doing, so we're always recording from the scalp, the easier it is to localize. Mm-hmm. So regions like the motor cortex is great. Looking at the visual cortex as well, which is the back of the head, is great. Other regions like the brainstem, kind of a bit more tricky, bit more debatable if you can really get to it. But so it really depends on the research question.
Okay. And so what was your research question? Looking at memories and trying to figure out whether or not when we forget something, it's properly forgotten.
Exactly, yeah. So traditionally, we've kind of looked at forgetting as kind of being caused by either the memory fading over time or it being interfered with in some way, shape, or form, perhaps other memories kind of jumbling up the mess and kind of distorting it. Mm. We were interested whether that's always the case, whether once we've forgotten, is that truly it? Is that memory actually gone, or is it still somewhere there bubbling under the surface? So we got participants in to take part in what is a relatively straightforward memory test, but we get them to watch short video clips and link those to words and these quite arbitrary associations. It's not the most thrilling task, but it's great in terms of scientific control. And then later on, we give them the words and ask them to try and remember the videos. And what we do at that moment is we look at the MEG and see what's going on in that activity. Mm. And seeing if we can find patterns of activity of the MEG, which is very specifically related to that video they watched earlier. And whether we can tell, if we can see patterns of that video coming back to life, which we would take as evidence that the memory is still there within the brain. And ultimately, we relate this back to whoever participants are able to say what they saw, able to describe the video they saw. And we do find a bit of a link that if you do bring that pattern back in the brain, you also tend to be able to vocalize it. But also there's a number of times when participants go, I don't have a clue, I can't remember what we saw, but we're very clearly able to pick up the patterns in the MEG, which sort of suggests the memory is still there in the brain somewhere, but it's just not popping out into awareness.
So you could see that they knew the answer, but not consciously.
Exactly, yeah.
And how much confidence do you have in that? Is it that the activity was very much correlating to the answer you were expecting? I mean, and like your interpretation of that, you're pretty confident in?
Yes, yeah. So we do a sort of some control analyses where we go, well, what if they were remembering a different video? What would it look like? What would the data suggest? And we come back very confident, but it's really, really specific to that particular video. They're not sort of misremembering it or bringing back different details, but actually something truly about that one event, that one video they saw.
I mean, this is apparent to anyone who knows they know the name of someone, but they can't remember the name of them right there and there. It is a sort of a second layer of knowledge, not present in the front of your mind, but you know it. And if you hear it, you'll know it's correct. You know, so if you're given five names, so we're consciously familiar that it is possible that something is on the tip of our tongue, but not consciously in our memory. What does it tell us about all of the memories that we have? Can we extrapolate from this experiment that perhaps many or a lot or a few of our memories are lying sort of under the carpet somewhere?
I think it's a really interesting question, and I'd definitely speculate that we remember a lot more than, or at least our brains remember a lot more than we think they do. Mm. I think it's quite a promising thing when we think about all these sort of the doom and gloom about memory loss and aging and things like that. It sort of gives a little bit of hope and promise on that front, that if we can just find a way to let it sort of bubble up and come above the surface, then actually we might be able to remember quite a bit more. In terms of percentages, I couldn't quite give you a number today.
No, of course. So in this experiment, if you gave them a hint, did they then get the right answer? Or did you try that?
This is what's coming up next. So we're now running a new study where we give them a little bit of a prompt, a little bit of hint of what they might be trying to remember, and then see if that helps them with the next part of the task. Still a bit of a work in progress. So
am I right in saying that this was known that it happened, but it's interesting to see it in the brain. Is that right?
I think it's one of these ones where there's definitely conventional wisdom that you brought up the example of tip of the tongue.
Yeah.
I think that's very much the case. I think a lot of people will go, yeah, that does make a lot of sense. But it's not a very prominent theory, I think, within neuroscience that people tend to look into either these memories fading away over time or just getting distorted. So to actually find some nice neural evidence for it is really fascinating, quite an advance on that front.
You talked about memories fading away and disappearing or just sort of lying underneath the surface. When you look at this pattern, do you expect that over time that pattern will just slowly become less powerful or completely disappear? Do we know what a memory looks like as it fades?
It's
because it's easy for us to say, oh, fade in my head. I imagine the visual sort of disappearing or the weakening of a signal, but that's not exactly how memories are stored, right?
You're not far off. I don't.
Oh, really?
So in that first instance, in that instance where you experience the event, it tends to be laid down, we think, within a region called the hippocampus, which holds on to it for a medium duration of time, maybe a few days, a few weeks. And then what slowly happens is it moves across to other parts of the brain where it gets stored long term. We think that the hippocampus has a much more vivid representation of what happened, much more detail, and as it moves into other brain regions, it tends to fade a little bit. It loses some of that uniqueness, and that might be a little bit why it fades over time. It might be a little bit due to interference. But yeah, losing things like that sort of visual specificity you mentioned, I think is very much what we also see on a neural level.
Well, I mean, if you think about an efficient brain, that process of coming from sharp resolution to lower definition longer term, like your Google photographs being saved in lower resolution, that kind of makes sense because it's less storage requirements, right? That process sounds like a brilliant evolutionary fix for keeping things in the brain but packing more in.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of growing interest in that sort of relationship between how the brain is able to store information and how computers are, particularly with this advance in AI, seeing whether we can take examples from what the brain is doing and see if we can help improve the efficiency of AI and improve computer storage, and how maybe that might make some of these big advances we're seeing in technology a bit more environmentally friendly.
But can we see what are they called? Memographs or engrams. See, look, there's a perfect example of it. It was on the tip of my tongue. These engrams. Can we now see these encapsulated memories physically stored in the brain? And are we sure that these engrams are actually memories with the information about a particular event or taste of food or a moment you had in time or that time you saw a shark? Can we actually say what a memory is in the brain now?
Not quite. I think there's still a little bit of debate. I think the world of animal research is kind of a bit further ahead of that than with the human brain. I feel there's still a little bit of controversy about the use of finding this human engrams. That's like the physical manifestation of the memory trace. What we're able to detect with MEG is sort of the dynamic pattern which comes out.
Yeah.
And we don't necessarily know if that's the memory itself or what the brain has sort of generated after the fact that the brain has gone, oh, I need to remember that video I watched. And it sort of starts to recreate it and reconstruct it. What we've got here, what we've got in the data, we can't tell the difference that's essentially between that at this moment in time. It's obviously still related to the memory. It's still got the same content, but it's not necessarily the physical nuts and bolts of what's stitching a memory together.
You talked about the recent memory and the longer memories being stored in different spots. And we see that actually when people have short-term memories, they might remember the name of their children, but they may not remember what happened in the last 24 hours. And that would suggest that there is this sort of compartmentalizing of recent and long-term memories. And I'm wondering, the activity that you saw of people remembering this particular association between the video and the word that you did in your experiment, if you keep scanning that same area, will you suddenly see that disappear, but the person still be able to remember because theoretically that memory is now moved into a new part of the brain?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there.
Wow. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of wild. So we do the experiment relatively quickly. It all kind of unfolds over the space of a couple of hours. They'll see some bits in the first half hour, and then later on, about an hour and a half in, they try and remember it. And it's still very much in the same spot there because it's still quite new. But if we did it over a week, gone back a week later, or, you know, a month later, it might have shifted and we might not be able to pick it up so clearly.
But as you say, what we're seeing there is the sort of the signal of the electricity as the memory is sort of conjured back up, as opposed to, you know, what I would love to see if we ever able to get the, you know, the exact frequency of a memory or the protein binding to something that is the physical deposit of that memory. We haven't figured out whether it's a particle or a wave yet.
No, I think the big theory is it's all about the connections between different neurons. So how these neurons interact with one another to help build bridges and help build concepts.
Mm.
But, I mean, another problem with trying to find this engram is maybe it is moving about the engram is stored in the hippocampus very early on, but then it moves to somewhere in the neocortex further in the future. And that just makes the task of pinning it down just that little bit harder.
Yeah. But the prize is so exciting. Right, figuring out how all that works. Really interesting work. Dr. Benjamin Griffiths is from the University of Nottingham. Ben, thanks for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, time to look back at some of your comments from last week's programme. And Anne-Marie dropped us an email. You know what? As soon as I said this out loud last week, I was thinking, is that right? And I've got to say, I'm lucky that that doesn't happen very often. I've trained myself not to really speak out when I'm not 100% sure. However, I screwed up last week and I am sorry. We were talking about folic acid and we were speaking to James Nestor about breathing. And he said, if you take your folic acid, you know, spina bifida, you know, is much less likely. I kind of said, oh yeah, we sort of do away with it. The stats are 50 to 70% of births with spina bifida are preventable. If folic acid is taken weekly. That's not all births, obviously. Anne-Marie says, I love the program, but as a mum of a 10-year-old with spina bifida who took folic acid long before I became pregnant, I feel the need to clarify the fact that the causes of spina bifida are complex and not fully understood. That I should have known, and I apologise for. Of course they are. It really is much more complex than taking folic acid. Of course it is. Sorry. I know it's really important to take folic acid, and I didn't realise the stats were actually nowhere near the numbers I thought they were. Ronan said, what is James's opinion of nasal dilators? Now, we often follow up when we've done an interview with someone and ask them, you know, what do you think of this or what do you think of that? Are we going to do that? Are we going to send an email to James about it? Why not? I think he'll say they're not a bad idea. Like if you are not getting a lot of air in because of your nasal passage, some people have tiny little openings on their noses. And some people, like in my family, have like these giant like air turbines in their faces, right? Like the McRae family nose is pretty legendary. We've got really big noses. And so we can get in a lot of air. If you had a really small nose opening, or for some reason you know keeping those open through nasal dilators, I think you can get like there's a sticker you can get to kind of keep it open, that kind of thing. I would say he'd be all for it. Let's ask him. But I haven't got the answer for you this week because our producer just thought they'd throw me this text and not actually give me an answer. So all I can do is read out your question and then speculate wildly as I have been doing every week for the last while. That's it from us in this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan producing, Aidan McKelvey, who pushed the buttons, Rory Galvin on podcast, and Hugo Da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.